are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. As Adolf Hitler rose to power in 1930s Germany, a growing wave of fascism began to take root on American soil. Nazi activists started to gather in major American cities, and by 1933, there were more than 100 anti-Semitic groups operating openly in the United States. Few Americans dared to speak out or fight back until an organized resistance of notorious mobsters waged their own personal war against the Nazis in their midst, gangland style. In this thrilling blow-by-blow account, acclaimed crime writer Michael Benson uncovers the shocking truth about the insidious rise of Nazism in America and the Jewish mobsters who stomped it out. Learn about Nazi Town USA, Meyer Lansky and Murder, Inc., Fritz Kuhn, The Vest Pocket Hitler, Newark Nazis versus the Minutemen, and Hitler in Hollywoodland. Packed with surprising, little-known facts, graphic details, and unforgettable personalities, Gangsters versus Nazis chronicles the mob's most ruthless tactics in taking down fascism, inspiring ordinary Americans to join them in their fight. The book culminates in one of the most infamous events of the pre-war era, the 1939 Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden, in which law-abiding citizens stood alongside hardened criminals to fight for the soul of a nation. This is the story of the mob that's rarely told, one of the most fascinating chapters in American history and American organized crime. The book that we're featuring this evening is Gangsters versus Nazis, How Jewish Mobsters Battled Nazis in World War II Era America, with my special guest, journalist and author, Michael Benson. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for this interview, Michael Benson.
Thanks for having me, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this, Gangsters versus Nazis. Let's talk about, as you do in the very first chapter, about Jewish gang that you titled Jewish Gangsters, and the Jewish migration to the United States, you say, began in the 19th century, largely from Central Europe, and many from Russia. Just tell us a little bit about how many Jewish people were in America at that time, near the turn of the century, and tell us a little bit more about the background of Jewish gangsters in America and why.
Well, the Jewish immigration rates escalated greatly in the first part of the 20th century, largely because Jews did not feel welcome in Europe anymore, and they were hoping to find a better life in America. A lot of the players in the book were children in Europe and remembered the way that Jews were treated in Russia in particular. I think people sometimes think that Adolf Hitler invented anti-Semitism, but in reality, it had been going on for thousands of years already. Right. And this was the latest wave of it. And they came over to America. A lot of them got as far as New York and stopped. Others moved further into the country. And there were Jewish communities in Minneapolis, in the Midwest, in Chicago, a lot of the major cities in the country, all the way out to the West Coast, where Los Angeles had a Jewish community and probably the only industry in the country that was dominated by Jewish men was Hollywood. But for most Jews, I mean, 99.9% of them, they had a very limited potential for success in America, where I guess it was better than it was in Russia because people weren't burning down their villages and raping their women. But they also weren't allowed to go into a lot of professions that Christians were allowed to do. So they were regulated to being butchers and tailors and things like that. And eventually you had ambitious Jewish men who weren't content with playing by Gentile rules and played outside the rules. They became criminals, gangsters. And particularly during Prohibition, you know, Jewish gangsters were among the top bootleggers in America. And because they made so much money, they were, I mean, next to the moguls of Hollywood, the most powerful Jewish people in the country.
You talk about emerging idolization by some Jewish kids and Jewish people by, yes. And you said that you called them this person, a Jewish superstar gangster, this Arnold Rothstein, and the veritable who's who crew of future gangsters. Tell us who this veritable crew that he basically recruits.
Well, the in Brooklyn at that time, there was a little pack of juvenile delinquents, you know, shaking down the corner stores and things like that, called the Meyer Bugs crew. And that was Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky, both of whom went on to become famous gangsters in their own right. And you know, Lepke was there, and a lot of the boys who would later be members of Murder, Inc., who play a big part in my book. Rothstein's probably most famous. Well, for one thing, he's fictionalized. I forget the name of his fictional character, but he's in The Great Gatsby. And he's best known, I think, for fixing the World Series, the Black Sox scandal of 1919, when the Chicago White Sox threw the World Series. That was Arnie Rothstein buying players. And Rothstein also was shot and killed in the Sheraton Hotel in New York, which happens to be the same hotel where generations later, Albert Anastasia was killed in the barber shop right off the lobby.
Right.
So if you're a gangster, I would suggest you steer clear of that particular hotel.
Yeah.
Anyway, and Lansky and Siegel, the leaders of their own little crew in Brooklyn, they went to work for Rothstein, and as adults, you know, became major players in you know, global economics. Lansky in particular was the right-hand man of Lucky Luciano, another fellow from the neighborhood. Now, I've always been amazed how you can have blocks where so many people become famous all being neighbors.
Yes.
As I remember, Joe Garagiola and Yogi Berra were both major league catchers in the 1940s, and they grew up across the street from one another.
Wow.
And Garagiola used to joke that, you know, I don't have much of an ego for a big league ball player because when I was growing up, I wasn't even the best ball player on my block.
Wow.
And that's the way it was. Eventually, Meyer Lansky is the alpha. But I mean, Bugsy Siegel and Mickey Cohen and other Jewish gangsters are also very, very powerful men. And after Prohibition ends, the Volstead Act is repealed, they almost seamlessly shift gears and go into gambling and become even richer and more powerful.
Talk about the rise in Europe with fascism and what was going on in Germany at this time.
Well, yeah, and by the mid-30s, you know, Adolf Hitler was in control of Germany, and his armies were pushing outward. The attempt was to conquer the world, I suspect. He was already fighting with Russia. He was knocking off the smaller countries of Western Europe. He had his eyes set already on Great Britain. And the Jewish communities of those countries were having, you know, terrible things happen to them. Really wasn't known among Gentiles. It wasn't really known in America that there was an attempted genocide going on already in Europe.
Right.
With the Germans trying to wipe out the Jews. But Jewish communities in America had an inkling that this was going on. I'm not sure they envisioned it in the scale that it inevitably ended up being. But they knew that Grandpa got picked up by the Germans and he hasn't come back. So when the German Americans who liked Hitler's attitude in the United States, when they started with the rhetoric of the Jewish problem and the ultimate solution to it, there were Jewish men who understood where that rhetoric was headed. So committing acts of violence against the American Nazis was not going to bother their conscience as much.
Now, you talk about that there wasn't going to be bothering some people, and we were alluding to these mobsters that get chosen through this very interesting route. But let's first talk about how Nazism manifests itself in the United States. What's Hitler's plan? What's his depiction of the situation in Germany and Europe for America? What's his plan? What's he want to convince Americans about?
Well, America's particularly vulnerable to disinformation in 1938 because we're almost a full decade into the Great Depression. No one has any money. It seems like nobody's had any money in a very, very long time. So if a German-American stood up on a podium and said, the problem is it's the Jews, they have all the money, they're all communists, and that's the reason why we're all poor. If we get rid of them, we will be richer. And although, you know, 99% of German-Americans saw this as hate speech and didn't listen to it, there was a small number, and it counts up to about 100,000, but compared to the number of German Americans, that's a small percentage, and who bought into this and attended rallies and listened to the speeches. And the idea, I think, in the short term was to get German Americans to vote as a bloc so that like-minded politicians would be in power. And in the long term, of course, it was the goal to turn the United States into a carbon copy of Nazi Germany. And I think that Hitler's original plan was to take over the United States without firing a shot. He thought that if he could take over Hollywood,
yeah,
which was run by Jews after all, he didn't have to lie about that. They really were in charge in Hollywood. If he could take over Hollywood and have them crank out pro-Nazi movies instead of anti-Nazi movies, he might be able to win the hearts and minds of Americans without having to go to war with them. But the problem was he didn't really put a strong leader in charge of that plan. He put four or five guys in there who all, instead of cooperating with one another, were competitive. And there was a Jewish lawyer in Los Angeles who caught wind of this. And the plan was just horrible. They were going to kidnap Jewish movie stars, Charlie Chaplin. They were going to kidnap the moguls, the Louis B. Mayers, the Joseph Skaggs. And they were going to hang them in public areas and then take over the movies. Now, I don't know how you're going to win the hearts and minds of Americans by performing public executions. I think that's a miscalculation, but that was the plan. And what the Jewish lawyer did, his name was L.L. Lewis, he put together a team of Jewish people who could pass as Gentiles and had them infiltrate the movement. Many of them were women, and they spread rumors about the four guys who were all trying to be in charge. This guy's stabbing this guy in the back. This guy said this about this guy. And pretty soon, the effort to take over Hollywood falls apart. And the Nazis that come in later, the German-American Bund, they're reduced to trying to recruit through homeless men. They set up soup kitchens, and then as now Los Angeles had a conspicuous homeless problem, and they would gather these guys up, feed them, and then inundate them with the disinformation about Jews. And if they started saying, yeah, we should kill the Jews, they got a uniform and they got to go out and march and have parades. So by the time my book starts, there's rising fascism with a German Nazi bent in many of the major cities in America, and Jewish leaders are starting to get sick of it.
You talk about some other groups as well, the Silver Shirts, and its relation to the Christian Front, and also any connection to the KKK.
Well, yeah, the German-American Bund was strictly were Hitler's army here in the United States. The Silver Shirts were run by a guy named William Dudley Pelley, who is an interesting character. He started out as a scenario writer in Hollywood during silent movies, and he claimed that he had a near-death experience and had gone to heaven, had a talk with God, talked with Jesus himself, and Jesus said, "Your work here is not done. You have to go back to Earth and make sure that you wipe out the Jews because that's what I want."
Sure.
And I think everybody knows why. Wink, wink, wink. This is Pelley's story, and he starts recruiting right-wing type men, once again giving them uniforms, although in this case they looked more like Boy Scouts than Army guys. I'm not sure who designed the uniforms. And because the German-American Bundists were called brown shirts because of their uniforms, he called his men silver shirts, although the shirts are actually light blue in color. And he said that, you know, if you're a Christian, you have to be anti-Jew and you have to be anti-communist. And one of his strongest mouthpieces was a Catholic priest who named Father Coughlin, who went on the air in a syndicated show every Sunday afternoon and would say in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, love Hitler and hate Jews. And not in so many words. He was cleverer than that. He had a very, very soft, caressing voice, so it made the hate speech seem more tolerable. But yeah, by the time the gangsters started fighting the Nazis in my book, anti-Semitism was in the very air. Oh, you mentioned KKK. Now, KKK was, of course, down with fighting against the Jews. Father Coughlin got no help from the KKK at all because he was a Catholic priest and he was on the list of people they hated as well. So that was a problem. But KKK got along with the Silver Shirts just fine. You know, I think after they had finished wiping out the Jews, they would have gone on to other groups as well. Certainly any kind of minority, any kind of infirm person, and eventually even Catholics.
Let's introduce U.S. Congressman, former U.S. Congressman and Special Sessions Judge Nathan Perlman. You say he was born in Poland. Tell us who he is.
Well, Judge Perlman is the hero of the book. He was a former congressman. He was among the congressmen repeal the Volstead Act and bring legal alcohol back to the United States, for which he was a hero, considered a hero by drinkers everywhere.
Yeah.
He used to walk into a bar and say, you know, I was one of the guys that voted to end prohibition and everybody wanted to buy him a drink.
Sure.
And he was a judge sitting on the bench in New York City and hated the German-American bun. But the last straw came in early 1938 when he went to a ceremony in Bowling Green, which is a little section of downtown Manhattan, right by the southern, not far from the World Trade Center now. And it faces the U.S. Customs Building, which is a great big building with pillars and gorgeous building. And there was a ceremony by the U.S. Maritime people on the front steps of the Customs Building. And there were, you know, American flags and the Pledge of Allegiance singing the Star-Spangled Banner. And during the ceremony, up marches a parade of the German-American Bund with their hate signs and they're chanting, you know, kill the Jews and love Hitler. And there was a standoff. It looked like there was going to be a big fight. But eventually, the maritime people moved inside the building, held their ceremony inside, and it just stuck in Judge Perlman's craw. The fact that good Americans had been forced to retreat because, you know, this garbage people were out there saying the things they were saying, he didn't know what to do. So he went to a bar, as he usually did, and he was sitting over a cocktail when he had an idea. So what these guys need is a good butt whipping.
Yeah.
He needed an army, but he didn't have one. So he was going to have to get one. It was going to have to be a Jewish army because they were the only ones who were going to be emotional enough about this stuff to actually fight. Had to be an army of guys who didn't mind breaking the law because they were going to have to punch people and you had to be comfortable with that. So he, the next day in his chambers, he picks up the phone and he calls Meyer Lansky, who he knows from some previous relationship. And I suspect it had more to do with one being a drinker and the other being a bootlegger than it did with anything to do with one being a judge and one being a criminal. I don't think it had anything to do with the justice system. But he knows Meyer Lansky. And he says, I need to have a meeting. So Lansky says, sure, come on over. And Perlman brings Rabbi Stephen Wise with him, just in case he needs to lay some guilt on Lansky to get what he wants. And it boils down. He says, you know, Meyer, these anti-Semites, they're organized. They've got newspapers backing them up. Something needs to be done. And Lansky says, you know, that bugs me too. I think we're on the same side there, Judge. He says, do you have some boys who might want to punch a Nazi? And Lansky says, well, sure. But to be honest with you, Judge, Rabbi, we can do better than punch. At which point the rabbi goes, no. There must be no killing. No, they're the killers. We're not killers. And Lansky sees the wisdom in this. Always better not to shoot. And Judge Perlman says, but teach them that it can be dangerous to be a Nazi in America. Teach them that we're not soft. We're not just going to take it. The Jews can be tough. And if they want to say this stuff about us, they better expect some blowback. So that's the deal. And they make an agreement. The only thing Lansky asks for is, please make sure you keep my name out of the newspapers. And just as fine. And the judge throws in, you know, if any of you get arrested, you know, we'll be there for you. Don't worry about any of that. He said, don't worry, we're pretty good at avoiding police anyway. So the next time the German-American Bund's going to get together is a big rally at the Yorkville Casino on East 86th Street in Manhattan. And they've been having these rallies fairly regularly, and they used to parade up and down 86th Street. See photos of it. It's just chilling. It looks like a Macy's Thanksgiving parade, except there's Sieg Heiling and goose stepping going on, and there are Nazi flags being held next to American flags. So Lansky does some exercises in team building. He takes the Jewish members of Murder, Inc., and in case there are people who don't know what Murder, Inc. is, there was a separate organization from the five families of the New York Mafia. And if anyone needed somebody killed among those five families, it would be a vote from the bosses, the commission it was called. And if they said, okay, then the job to kill the guy was farmed out to Murder, Inc., and they would go out and do the job. And they represented none of the five families. They were a separate entity. And the idea was to prevent civil wars from breaking out or wars between families from breaking out, which is what happened when anybody was allowed to kill anybody. So it was an orderly fashion and it was working. And he had guys who knew how to use guns, but not necessarily guys who knew how to use their fists. Some of them did because they'd been juvenile delinquents and been in a lot of fights, but some didn't. So what Lansky does, he takes them to Gleason's gym, which at that time is in the Bronx. It's in the Dumbo section of Brooklyn. Now it's moved a few times. And Gleason himself teaches these guys how to throw a few combos. And so by the time the next rally takes place at the Yorkville Casino, the boys are ready. And they split up into three sections. One goes in the front door, one hangs out outside, and one climbs up a fire escape and goes into an upstairs window. And the murdering guys are just shocked by what they see. I mean, it's Hitler's birthday, so there's a celebration going on. They're singing happy birthday to Hitler. There are American flags, again, next to swastika flags up on the stage. There is a portrait of George Washington next to a portrait of Adolf Hitler. And all of this is because the first attempt to start a pro-Hitler organization in America was called the Friends of New Germany, and they got shut down for being anti-American. So the new edition is now called the German American, but it says American even in the name. What are you talking about, un-American? So I think the last thing that is said at the rally is, and the Jews were responsible for the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby, at which point the fights start. And the closest the gangsters ever came to breaking the no-kill rule, and Lansky himself was part of this, is they dangled a particularly loudmouth Nazi out the second floor window. So should we or should we? And then eventually they just dropped him. And if he'd landed on his head, he'd have been dead. But he lands on one leg and breaks his femur instead. And the fight lasts 2-3 minutes tops. And the reason we have the details we do is because a Jewish journalist by the name of Judd Teller is there.
Right.
He was in on it. So he was there to write about it later in retrospect, although not really at the time, because nobody in the room during the fights wants their name in the paper the next day. Nobody wants to be known as a Hitler lover, and nobody wants to be known as a gangster. So, and one of the smart things that Lansky does before the fight starts is he opens up a box of brand new American Legion hats. So before all the gangsters go into the Yorkville Casino, they put on the American Legion hats. They fight with the hats on. If the cook gets knocked off during the fight, okay. Anyway, but if you still have it on by the time you're leaving, toss it on the sidewalk. And sure enough, you know, the next day, the newspapers say, well, there was a riot. We think there was American Legion guys against the Nazi guys. The American Legion didn't mind being blamed too much because a lot of them had fought in World War I and didn't like the idea of Germans becoming aggressive again. And it was a trick that Lansky learned from Albert Anastasia, who used to put Chicago hats made in Chicago on his hit teams before they'd whack somebody. Then they'd lose the hats on the way out, and the police wouldn't bother looking for the crew that did it because they were probably halfway back to Chicago already, when in reality, the killers were sitting in the back room of a candy store in Brownsville, Brooklyn. So the fight only lasts 2-3 minutes. It ends with Lansky and the boys chasing 3 or 4 Nazis down the street. And that's it. After the fight, Fiorello LaGuardia, who doesn't like the Nazis any more than Meyer Lansky does, makes a new set of rules. So you can't wear uniforms anymore unless it's an American uniform. You can't have any more parades. And what basically happens is the big rallies in Manhattan stop. And what they do is they start up again in Newark, New Jersey. They cross the Hudson River and start up again in Newark, New Jersey. So Judge Perlman calls Longies Willman, who's the ex-bootlegger who's running the rackets in Newark, and has a conversation very similar to the one he had with Lansky. And what Zwillman says is, you know, we're a little bit ahead of you here. We've already got guys ready for this. When they come, we're ready for them. And they're called the Minutemen. And in Newark, by far the biggest number of Jewish men ready to fight in as a team to get rid of, to rid the town of the Nazis. And they were not just gangsters. They were also professional boxers. And this we see for the rest of the book is that, well, first of all, there's a blurred line between boxer and gangster in 1938 anyway, because boxing's run by gangsters, and a lot of fighters during their careers and after their careers went to work for gangsters doing tough guy stuff. They were bouncers and collectors and whatever needed to be done. So there's a lot of guys who aren't technically gangsters, but they're under orders from Longies Willman, Abner Longies Willman, who is a gangster, and they're dishing out some serious hurt at the German American Bund meetings in Newark, which are held in places like the Schwabenhall, which is fun to say. I'm sorry.
What is the Nazi reaction? What are the attendees' reaction? What is the leadership's reaction to these and response? How do they try to react to these attacks?
Well, first of all, especially at the Yorkville Casino, there's just complete shock, because Judge Perlman was right. The Bundes never considered that they might be attacked by Jewish men. They thought the Jews were soft, that they would just take it. A lot of them had been bullying Jewish little boys since they were little boys, and they just didn't worry about that. So when these men who come in and they're tough guys and they're doing serious damage, they're stunned. They try to flee. I mean, most of the Germans at these riots were uninjured because they ran and they managed to get out of the building and run home or run to their car, depending on where the fight was. So later on, I think there's more fisticuffs. The fact that at no time does anybody shoot anybody is just stunning. You know, I think one of the questions I get most often is, could this happen today? And no, because somebody would get shot in the first 30 seconds and that would be that. Everybody would scatter after that. These were more, they were more like rumbles, like you might find between juvenile delinquent gangs in the 50s. And I think West Side Story to a certain extent is a story about how we graduated as a combating culture from fist fights to using guns. But in 1938, you could do it. The only gun that gets fired is at the very end of one fight in Newark where somebody fires a shot into the ceiling and that just signals everybody to get out. But yeah, it was almost like they were playing by playground rules. You don't bring a knife to a fist fight. You don't bring a gun to a knife fight, et cetera. And nobody escalated it beyond, I mean, the biggest weapons that were used were baseball bats, sawed off pool cues, and brass knuckles. And those were specifically okayed by Judge Perlman.
We're going to talk about Judge Perlman making a call to Chicago. But before that, let's use this opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. It was a typical night. Lisa and I had some dinner. We both talked about work, and then suddenly I disappeared. But not to worry, I was just off getting some quality time playing Best Fiends. Others may wonder about your sudden disappearances, but I totally understand if you're having as much fun playing as I do. What I enjoy the most about Best Fiends is that I can totally lose myself in playing, getting away from my too serious occupation. I'm amazingly at level 2200 right now, with so many levels left to achieve. It's easy just to play a few levels anytime you have a little time to spare. It feels good to beat another level or get in the zone. Best Fiends is a free-to-download mobile puzzle game that has thousands of levels, new adventures, and challenges every time. There are dozens of unique fiends to collect to build a team of fiends to fight the menacing slugs, and you'll never be stranded if you lose your internet connection. New events and challenges come up all year round. You're always able to earn exclusive in-game items, characters, and rewards. Download your new favorite getaway, Best Fiends, for free today on the App Store or Google Play. You'll even earn $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Now, Michael, I mentioned Judge Perlman makes a call to Chicago, and another important character in this book is Herb Brin. Tell us about Herb and the situation in Chicago.
Sure. Well, in Chicago, the Jewish neighborhood flanked Kedzie Avenue, and Brin's hardware store, Davy Miller's boxing gym, and with an upstairs pool hall, and the restaurant next door where Al Capone used to hold court, were all within a few hundred yards of each other, which this proximity comes into play because these are the characters that are eventually going to be used to combat the Nazis in Chicago. Herb Brin is the son of the owner of Brin's Hardware. He is a Jewish journalist, and the key to him is that he could pass for Gentile. We talked a little bit about in Hollywood about how they used spies. And he was contacted by the Anti-Defamation League and B'nai B'rith, who are also part of this. But the amount of organization between those groups and Judge Perlman's unknown. But Perlman calls the top Jewish gangster in Chicago, which is Greasy Thumb Guzik. And Guzik is Al Capone's right-hand man. He did some time for tax evasion. Capone was still in prison. So Guzik was calling the shots, and he's right next door to Davy Miller's boxing gym where the Jewish fighters all train. And upstairs, there's other ne'er-do-well Jewish young men who are out playing pool and hustling and doing that kind of thing. And Herb Brin knows these guys because he grew up at his dad's store and hung around, you know, wasting his childhood away playing pool. And he's contacted by Anti-Defamation League and because he could pass for Gentile. I spoke to both of Herb's sons. They're very proud of him. And don't say he was blonde and blue-eyed because he wasn't. Okay, well, he had sandy hair and brown eyes, but he could pass for Gentile, and that was the key part. And he infiltrates the German-American Bund in Chicago. And by this time, they're not putting up posters saying where the next meeting is going to be because of the problems in Newark and New York. It's known that if you advertise, opposition will show up. So we're at a different stage of consciousness by the Germans. They know there's trouble and they're keeping themselves as secret as possible. But with Herb Brennett at the meetings, of course, the word is out immediately. Now, the actual fighters that Guzik sends are the boys next door, and they include Barney Ross, who was a multi-division boxing champion who was in the last days of his boxing career.
Right.
And a fellow by the name of Sparky Rubenstein, who's a funny little guy, kind of a hustler. He was Chicago's number one ticket scalper. If you went to any sporting event, you would get to see Sparky out front trying to sell tickets for, you know, more than their box office price.
Sure.
And then there was Davey Miller. And Davey Miller was not a boxer. He was a referee and had refereed some of the top heavyweight fights. But he goes along too because they're all of one mind once they get the order to go bust up German-American Bund meetings. And it's an interesting side note is that Sparky becomes famous later in life in a completely different context. He changes his name to Jack Ruby.
Yes.
And becomes a nightclub operator in Dallas, Texas, and quite famously commits the first murder on live TV when he shoots alleged JFK assassin Lee Harvey Oswald in the basement of the Dallas Police Department while Oswald is being transferred to the county jail on November 24th, 1963, 2 days after the president was shot. So Ruby goes on, and after Ruby shoots Oswald, he's, I want everybody to know the Jews are tough. And he starts saying stuff, comes right out of the Judge Perlman
playbook.
Yeah. And except for one thing is that in 1938, they were punching people who wanted to commit genocide. And in 1963, he was silencing someone who could have cast light on how it is that the assassination came about.
Right.
So nobody thought of him as a hero.
No.
They thought of him as a guy who was working for the mob and there to cover up whatever had happened to Kennedy. So those are the guys that fight in Chicago. And there's no need to take them to see a boxing coach to teach them how to throw combinations. They know. And by this time, the Germans are a little more aware that they're liable to have problems, and they don't react with quite the fear and shock as they had on the East Coast. But they're no matches for these guys. They raise their fists and they're just, they're buried by, one, twos, and down they go. Which reminds me of the story that after the Yorkville Casino riot in New York, the next day there were, I think there were 7 or 8 arrests, and all of them were Germans. And the next day, the judge of the morning court looks out at the sad, bandaged men. They went from the emergency room to jail, and they're all represented by Jewish lawyers. And the judge says, well, see, it just goes to show how great America is. I mean, you're spending your time bad-mouthing Jews, claiming that you want Jews wiped off the face of the earth. And these Jewish men are here to get you out of trouble.
Incredible.
And what the judge did is he figured these guys with their broken noses and their scalps busted open, they'd learned their lesson. So he scares them a little bit, and then he sends them all home. And sure enough, I would guess that none of those men ever went to another German-American Bund rally. Their wives wouldn't let them. And that as from city to city to city was how the plan to get German Americans to vote as a block fell apart.
You write about October 11th, 1938, and Bernard Cohen, a 9-year-old, was attacked on his way to school. Tell us what this act and the reaction from Americans.
Well, this is the fellow who was cut, right? He was
swastika in his arm.
They held him. Yeah, they held him down, and then they carved swastikas into him, which is just sickening to think about. But it's weird because Nat Arno, who was the leader on the ground of the Newark Minutemen who fought the Nazis there, he had told a lie. I mean, he was interviewed by a member of the press, and he told a lie that he was mad at the Nazis because they had carved up some kid and then hung him from a tree And this was why they were after the Nazis, as if lying about the Nazis was necessary.
Yeah.
But for some reason, Ed Arno did. And then once it was out of his mouth, he couldn't take it back. So there was a suspicion that the actual incident in which the kid was cut and left, of course, with swastika shaped scars was life imitating the lie that Arno had told. But if anything, it made the gangsters fight harder. Not all of the combat between the gangsters and the Nazis was in large groups. They weren't all riots. In each city, American Defamation League came up with lists of Nazi sympathizers, probably by taking down license plate numbers outside of meetings and things like that. And in pairs, the gangsters would go out. And when these guys came out of their houses, they'd brace them, punch them in the stomach a couple of times and say, "Hey, you shut up about Jews." Because the object was not to kill the Nazis. World War II hadn't happened yet. That was a horrible thought. The object was to get them to shut up. And, I think that one of the most refreshing things about my book is that in my book, nobody gets killed, although there is mass murder going on in Europe as it takes place. No one gets killed in my book. And the object is not to bury these people. It is merely to silence them and teach them that if you want to say these things, you have to expect that somebody's going to punch you in the nose.
There is a big community of Nazi sympathizers and Bund members or future Nazis in Minneapolis. And there is also a very important figure in this, also William Dudley Pelley, that you had mentioned. So tell us a little bit about the situation in Minneapolis.
Well, Minneapolis had an extremely large pro-Nazi community. I mean, its German population was probably on the average of other cities across the country, but for some reason there were more haters there. And I'm not quite sure why that is, but these would be particularly, Judge Perlman is aware of this, and he calls Davy Berman, whose nickname was Davy the Jew, not a nickname you hear that much anymore, sort of like Whitey, and other like Whitey Ford. We don't use nicknames like that anymore.
Yeah.
But Davy Berman was the leader of the anti-Nazi crews in the Twin Cities. And one night in 1938, his crew received word that the Silver Shirts were holding a rally at the Elks Club. So Berman contacted his fighting crew and told them to meet at the Radisson Hotel. The Radisson Hotel was where he had his headquarters, right on the river there in Minneapolis. And once assembled, Davy handed out some brass knuckles, some fungo bat. You know what that is? It's bat specifically designed for hitting the ball out of your hand. Sawed off pool cues. And he said, and I believe this is a quote, "Put on the nux, boys. Hit them right in their stupid little toothbrush mustaches." So his crew was 12 strong, a 13 if you counted Davy himself. And they drove in three cars to the Elks Lodge and assembled near the front door. And the meeting was underway. And there was a Silver Shirt at the podium delivering a speech about, this again, a quote, "the Jew bastards in this city." And taking that as their cue, Berman's gang invaded the meeting. And for 10 minutes, they busted Nazi heads. And by the time the beatdown was over, all of the Nazis were either on the floor or they'd managed to find a way out of the building. At which time Berman went to the podium, his suit spotted with Nazi blood, and delivered a speech of his own to the wounded in the room. He said, "This is a warning. Anybody who says anything against Jews gets the same street treatment, and the next time it will be worse. Tell your pal Hitler that it's a dangerous thing being an anti-Semite in Minneapolis." At which point Berman pulled his gun, because he had one with him, and fired a single shot into the ceiling. And that is the only shot fired by the Jewish fighters in my entire book.
You moved to Los Angeles, and you had mentioned a little bit about Hollywood land and Hitler's interest in it for sheer propaganda purposes. But tell us what the situation was in Los Angeles.
Well, in Los Angeles, we have two of Lansky's good childhood friends, Bugsy Siegel and Mickey Cohen are both there. And out of all the stories, I used as research in my book, the one I waxed the most skeptical about is Benjamin Bugsy Siegel punching Nazis. And Mickey Cohen claims he did, And we know that this is still part of Judge Perlman's program, because Cohen says, I got a phone call from a judge back east, doesn't name him because he's not going to rat him out. Obviously, a judge would be in big trouble if he found out that he was making these phone calls to gangsters, urging them to commit crimes. And that is the weird thing about my book, is that the good guys commit all the crimes and the bad guys don't, because there were no hate speech laws in 1938. So as long as you didn't shout fire in a crowded room or say something obscene, you could talk about killing Jews all you wanted and you weren't breaking the law.
Right.
But anyway, Bugsy Siegel was a gunman, and he was proud of it. I saved my hands for the broads, he'd say, which, because he was a violent man, wasn't always good for the broads. But he didn't touch men with his hands. But Mickey Cohen said he made an exception in this case. And again, these guys did not need to be taught how to fight. Mickey Cohen was a fighter as a child. That's another thing about 1938 that's a little upsetting, is that children were encouraged to box. Little boys, anyway. And they, every year in big cities, they would have the newsboy boxing tournament, and grown men would go and watch as 12-year-olds pummeled each other, and they would bet on the matches. But Mickey Cohen came out of this, and he fought hundreds of fights as a child, and as a professional, maybe 2 or 3 dozen more before he became a full-time gangster. And one of the most famous anti-Semite confrontations took place when Mickey Cohen was in a holding cell in an LA County jail, and found himself in the same jail cell, probably not by coincidence, with 2 anti-Semites. And when the guard who had just put Mickey in there walked away for a moment, conveniently, Cohen just went up to the 2 of the guys and bonked their heads together, like Superman would do in the 50s TV show. Pow!
Yeah.
And the guard comes back, and Cohen's sitting there reading a newspaper, and the other 2 guys are unconscious with big bumps on their heads. He says, I don't know, they got in a fight with each other. I don't know what it was all about, but maybe they might need a doctor. So in LA, you had celebrity fighters, which I guess is probably, it's very Hollywood-like, that you would have your movies. The one gangster in the book with movie star good looks is the guy who's on the Sunset Strip punching Nazis.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, we did talk about in the very beginning, in the opening, about the most famous anti-Nazi incident. And the most famous incident in this book is the Madison Square Gardens, February 20th, 1939. And we haven't spoken about the 2 characters that keep popping up as noted speakers, William Kuhn and... I'll get you to pronounce the other Nazi's name.
It's Fritz Kuhn and William Kuhns.
There we go. Thank you.
Very, very similar. Very similar names.
Yes.
Well, Fritz Kuhn saw himself as America's Hitler. He worked for the Ford Motor Company, and Henry Ford being a notorious anti-Semite. Although if that is relevant, we're not sure. But we do know that Kuhn is fired from his job at the Ford Motor Company for, one, doing his Hitler impressions in the photographic darkroom.
Jeez.
And 2, bothering women. He considered himself quite a ladies' man, apparently. And he claimed that he had been with Hitler during the 1923 Beer Putsch, which was the beginning of the revolution that led to the Nazis being put in power years later. First time Adolf Hitler ever got his name in the newspaper was in 1923 after the Beer Putsch, which was a fight. And in the fight, Hitler separates a shoulder. He needs some medical attention. Kuhn says he's there. What we do know for a fact is that there is a photo of Kuhn and Hitler shaking hands, and he had it blown up and framed and put on the wall of his office.
Sure.
And he claimed that he was in America by Hitler's orders to, you know, take over, and to do that first by a democratic fashion, if possible, to get German Americans to vote together. And once we got some Nazi thinking politicians into political office, then we work from there. So Kuhn sets up the German American Bund with branches all over the country. He sets up, and this is the thing that bothers me most about the entire story, he sets up Nazi youth camps.
Yeah.
Not in Germany, but on Long Island, New York, Catskills in New York, and just outside of Los Angeles, and across the country, usually outside of a large populous area where there are German Americans, but far enough outside the town so that the city police aren't responsible for anything that goes on there. And he would recruit boys and girls And the recruiting pamphlets said nothing about Nazis, said nothing about Hitler, said German pride. Your kid will learn how to speak better German. Plus, they'll swim and play baseball and run and play and all the things you get at summer camp. And then when the children would show up, they would see swastikas everywhere, and there would be a nightly lecture in loving Hitler, hating Jews, and they were given uniforms and taught how to goose step. It's just appalling. And then on Sundays, the proud parents would get to come out and find out, some of them for the first time, what's been going on at camp, and the kids would have parades for them, and American politicians would show up and give speeches, seemingly unaware of the fact that being anti-Semitic was also being anti-American. They're just completely oblivious to that. So, and Kuhn, and this is true, I found almost across the board among the Nazis, I guess when 0.2% of a group belongs to a hate group, you figure they're probably not the best citizens in other ways as well.
Right.
But there are a lot of ne'er-do-wells in the Bund, and Kuhn was among them. He was an alcoholic. He drank constantly. He was a loner. He drove from outpost to outpost alone in a car, but often terribly intoxicated. Twice he woke up with his car hanging off a bridge. And after he was eventually arrested for embezzling from his own country, like from his own organization, people would send him the money for uniforms and he'd just keep it. They'd complain about not getting their uniforms. He'd say, well, look, next time I'm around, I'll bring some. But he was becoming a rich man off of spreading the word of Hitler, and he wasn't sharing it with his troops. Now, Kuhn's, he was another fellow who was chosen pretty much because he could give a rousing speech. And when Kuhn was not around, William Kuhn's would be the headline speaker. But most of our photos of him are standing behind and to the left of Kuhn. And there seems to be a disproportionate number of photos of Kuhn's with a swastika right behind his head. So it looks like he's wearing a swastika halo. It's a very, very odd image. And those were the two guys that ran the Bund. And they were breaking no laws. They were protected by the First Amendment. Of course, until Pearl Harbor changed everything.
Yes.
And when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, all of a sudden, all of that free speech turned into sedition. And they were all breaking the law if they said anything that was anti-American or pro-German. And everybody's role changes. The Germans who are attending these rallies, a lot of them are drafted into the U.S. Army and sent to the Pacific, where their allegiances will not be questioned. And the Jewish fighters, many of them are drafted, and many of them enlist, and they go to Europe and fight Nazis with guns this time. Nat Arno, the Newark fighter, he was among those who invaded on D-Day and right. The beaches of Normandy. He marched all the way to Berlin, touring Europe the hard way, and claims that on a couple of occasions, he saw German POWs being marched in the opposite direction, who he recognized and who recognized him from street fights they'd had in Newark, New Jersey. So it really was the little war before the big war.
As you say, the tide turned and these people were on the run, no more Bund, and these people's missives turned into crimes. So you further chronicled the fate of not only some of the Nazis, like these two speakers, but also some of the heroic mobsters that were enlisted by Judge Perlman and their fate.
Yeah, you know, the gangsters do not have long life expectancies.
No.
And although the heroes of my book were doing heroic things from page one to page 300 or whatever it is, before the book starts and after the book's over, they go back to their day jobs, which is being professional killers. They're not good men. And a lot of them pay the price. Lansky, who is a rare honest gangster, he would make deals with other gangsters and then keep his word. In other words, they were illegal deals, but they were honest ones. He survives, and he ends up growing to be old. Eventually, cigarettes that kill him. As for the Nazis, William Pelley lands on his feet, which is interesting. He was the survivor. I guess he went back to heaven, and Jesus said, "I was just kidding." But he shifts. It's pretty much the same paranoia speech, but he shifts from Jews to UFOs. And he started telling stories about ancient aliens and things like that. So he has success after World War II, but almost everybody else comes to a bad end. And, you know, Nat Arno becomes a full-time gangster after the war, doing what he was probably always destined to do. And I've had Jewish readers who have said that they object to the word gangster, that if these men had been in Palestine, they would have been called survivors. Also, I've noticed that I've given many speeches to a lot of varying crowds. You know, I've spoken at synagogues. I spoke at through a Zoom type arrangement to a group at Fort Knox of Army soldiers. So predominantly Jewish and predominantly Gentile. And what I found was that your Christian audiences seem to find this to be a little compartment of history, and they're kind of a cute little anecdotal story that took place before the big story of World War II. And my Jewish audiences see it as just another part of a long story that's been going on for thousands of years.
Right.
And as is absolutely still going on today.
You also talk about Herb Brin.
Yes.
The journalist that infiltrated and really was instrumental in gathering information for the cause. And he does fare well, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. No, Herb Brin is a healthy and happy man into his 80s, and he's still fighting anti-Semitism. As an 80-year-old man, he goes into a neo-Nazi camp and, again, pretending to, or at least not admitting to being Jewish, says he's interested, and he distracts the receptionist long enough to go around and rifle through all the drawers and stealing documents, as many as he can stuff into his pockets. And out of this, he gets a series of articles he writes about the state of the Nazi Party in America at that time. He continues being a fighter of Nazis right up until old age. It's amazing.
You also talk right about Judge Perlman. He becomes a consultant to the Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, who was appointed by President Truman, ironically, fittingly, to prosecute Nazi war criminals.
Yes. Yeah. The war against Nazis, obviously, in the during the spring of 1975, de-escalates a great deal with the surrender of Germany and the occupation of Berlin. But it never really stops. It never really completely ends. Not only were some of the most horrible Nazis, did they survive World War II and had to be chased down and tried later, but like-minded people in future generations have taken up their cause. And we're still, you know, trying to puzzle out how to stop hate in the world. And certainly hate against Jews seems to be disproportionate, certainly considering, you know, I've met thousands of Jews in my life and every single one seemed to be pretty nice. Alan, there was one, but it but never mind. Yeah. Never mind.
What we do detail in this book, though, and I think that we've not purposely, but we've glossed over, is that when you hire people of the ilk of Murder, Inc., and they have an itching to kill, and they would have loved to kill these people that were sympathizing with the Nazis and spewing this hate, but they did dish out some extreme beatings that you do chronicle in this book. For all those people that may want to read those kinds of graphic details, it certainly is filled with the details of how much of a beating they inflicted on these people.
Well, right. I think that I made a conscious choice while writing the book to translate all of the violence into cinema type action sequences. So I think they're a little bit easier to absorb without being offended by the violent nature of what's actually going on. I was afraid if I approached the subject academically, or if I started to lay in too heavy to the Holocaust and what was going on the other side of the ocean, that the temptation would be to weigh one against the other.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly what the Nazis were doing to the Jews in Europe is thousands, millions, infinity times worse than anything the Jews were doing to Nazis in America. Sorry, a couple of guys got their skulls busted, but we're in a world now where almost every Jewish person has a relative died during Hitler's regime because they were, you know, there's an attempt to exterminate them. And today there are Orthodox Jewish communities who may seem odd to Christians with odd rules until you realize that they're concentrating on repopulating their own flock. The reason they don't want to mix is because, first of all, outsiders aren't to be trusted. And there used to be millions of them, and now there are thousands of them. And this is it. So it's perfectly all right for them to stick to their own and marry their only their own kind and have new Jews being born with Jewish mothers and fathers. And it makes perfect sense because we don't know what it's like to have our tribe almost wiped out.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what, unless we're a Native American, in which case we would probably have a pretty good idea. That's another thing we didn't touch upon is that Hitler sort of got the idea from America.
Yeah, he had a great example of how to decimate a population.
Yes. Anyway, yeah. So for any Americans out there feeling like, we're the good guys. Yeah, sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. I want to thank you very much, Michael Benson, for coming on and talking about your latest, Gangsters versus Nazis, How Jewish Mobsters Battled Nazis in World War II Era America.
Dan, always a pleasure.
It's been a fascinating time spent speaking with you, Michael Benson. You have a great evening and good night.
You too, Dan. Good night.